It's a joy to see all of you manifestations of Shiva, of Allah, of the real self, here on another Saturday night, Satsang. So we'll continue a little bit with visiting a Sufi master, Sheikh Attar. But we've been going over the poems on the horizontal dimension in a certain way, more concerned with behavior, virtues, dharma, the sadhana. But let's deal with the vertical dimension of it. And I'm going to read only a few, because the truth is every poem has the same message. Although there are certain different obstacles that the master brings into focus in these poems, it's the same very simple yet ultimate conclusion that is called for. And yet, it doesn't seem to happen. So let's understand why that is this evening. Starting with the number 106 on page 27. Every day 100 calls come to you from the friend, but too self-indulged are you to acknowledge. You see, if you're too concerned with the ego, you won't hear the call of God, even though you're being called and given signs all the time. Number 108, a good number. Safety is to wash your hands of yourself and to see yourself a lifeless shadow. Interesting. If you don't wash your hands of yourself, you're a living corpse. But if you do, you're a lifeless shadow. But the truth is, even the shadow has to disappear, which he makes clear in other poems. And it's safety. This is interesting. If you want to be safe, because the ego's main concern, it's chakra one, its first assemblage point, obsession is with its safety, its security. It wants to always make sure it feels safe, right? This is the signature of the weak fragment of the ego. Every ego has a weak fragment and a strong fragment, right? Or actually, it can be a number of fragments, but there will usually be one that is strongest and one that is weakest. In a healthy ego, the strongest aspect of the ego will take over, and the weak will serve the strong and gradually become stronger and be able to grow under the guidance and the aegis of the strong fragment. But in a pathological ego, the strong one is made to serve the weak. And if the strong one serves the weak, then its strength is used simply to assure its security for the weak one on the phenomenal plane. And it cripples itself. And it turns its strength into weakness. Because it ratifies the reality of the weak fragment. And it says, no, I can't go out and stand alone and become great and independent because my weak fragment will feel abandoned. So I have to follow and do what the weak one needs, which is to assure its security by clinging on to someone else or something, or betraying itself in some way, or compromising its life and never living to the full. And it calls that self-betrayal love. The worldly, and this is number 110, the worldly are like mad dogs. They devour this corpse of a world in their ignorance and will tear apart anyone who suggests otherwise. So this is the chakra 3 ego, devouring, still out of security need, but now the strong one is turned into aggressive and bullying and dominant. And it wants to devour the world, but not in the way that Zorba meant it, but it means to devour it in the sense of consuming all the jouissance possible and to rape nature and to do whatever is needed to become successful in worldly terms while selling its soul to the devil. And so the mad dogs are now running the world. Mad dogs and Englishmen, of course. At least they think they're running the world. Not anymore, but they're acting that way. So the mad dogs are within and not just without. Now here's an interesting one, which is kind of like the water treatment on steroids. Number 118, the story. Sheikh Abu Sayyid of Mena, the Sultan of the Path, was asked by a bystander to intercede and save from the constable's wrath a man who, while being beaten severely, was pleading to be spared and took God's name repeatedly. "How can I oblige, friend?" said the saint. But only now and thus is he reminded of God. All right? Okay, so here is a saint, right? The compassionate bodhisattva saying, "No, I'm not going to intercede in the guy's being beaten up." Why? Because this is actually bringing him closer to God. This is the secret of karma. People always wonder, why is there suffering? Because for the ego, especially for the weak or the aggressive or the paranoid ego, it's only that suffering that will humble one and enable one to be obedient to God, to be faithful, to surrender, to submit at least to the forced acceptance of one's karma. Because otherwise the ego never accepts its karma. It's pissed. It's pissed at God. It's pissed at others. It wants to blame everyone for its bad fortune and doesn't recognize that it's his own dream that it's consuming in its wrath against its own failure to realize its true nature. 120. I'm afraid of sinking in this ocean, so I busy myself with trinkets on the shore, fattening my ego, starving my soul. So that's what the ego tends to do, and it calls it spirituality. Instead of going through ego death, it'll learn hatha yoga, or it'll read scriptures, or it'll do something else that enables the ego to survive, and the weak one to be coddled by others, and to get some weekend seminar diploma that allows it to call itself a Reiki master or some other kind of shingle that it can put out and claim to be somebody in the spiritual realm. But it has only gotten a few trinkets, and it has failed to commit itself to the deep ocean of consciousness and never knows what's below the surface of its own crust of fear, really, of fear of the void, because the ocean is the abyss, the emptiness in which there is nothing to hold on to. And it's that we don't want. I want a formula. I want a practice. I want a regimen. I want to know what I should do. I want to know who I should follow. I want to know, all of the landmarks of my a phenomenal existence. I want certainty. But if you want the real, you must settle for indeterminacy. But the ego is terrified of that. And it's terrified of letting go of its belief that it knows, when it knows deeply that it doesn't know anything. Verse 121, unmindfulness. This is a very important one. To see a locked gate where there's only a curtain and to be end up left out in the rain, right? You tend to assume, the ego tends to assume that it's being rejected by a teacher if it is corrected and that it's being locked out when in fact it's being offered a curtain through which it can let go of that which had failed to recognize its true divine royalty and pass through that gate by accepting humbly the need to let go of its false master's discourse. And when the strong fragments of the ego fail to gain real strength, right? And what is real strength? And why does the weak part not want the strong to lead? It's because it's risky. It's because if the strong, healthy part of the ego were allowed to lead, it would dare to go through ego death. And that's what terrifies the weak part. It's the last thing it wants. And so it has to pretend the gate has been locked so it doesn't dare go through. And it can blame the other for locking it out. And then it closes its heart, and indeed then it locks itself out of the Shakti gate and the throne of God. 122. O worshiper of yourself, your ego self, isn't it time for the demon you carry within to prostrate itself? Every breath taken in ego adds to that dark smoke that settles in your chest. Atar has revealed what he knows. Now then, the decision is yours. It's a decision that few can take, given the psychological internal conflicts that prevent self-sovereignty that is required to make such a decision. Let's see, 140. In this prison of illusions, be insignificant. Vanish in this sea. Be not even a drop. All creation is a mirror reflecting God's face. Let the face be your delight, not the mirror. So there mustn't be even a drop that remains separate from the sea. Not even that lifeless shadow from the other poem. Not even the shadow of a drop. There is only the face of God. 141. While here, cease this scatteredness in your heart. For tomorrow in your grave, this would be very difficult. Seek Huzur, the presence, here. So there you will not feel lonely and out of place. Have you yet faced the reality of your death? Because, you know, we're dead a lot longer than we are alive. So our death is much more important than life. Life is over like that. But death can be your condition for a long time. And it can be in any kind of bardo state. You know, death isn't just a deep sleep. No, it can be some very troubled dreams if you haven't resolved your issues while alive. And if you're scattered and not concentrated on the real self, all of those scattered fragments will become wrathful deities after death. So tomorrow, when you're dead, it's very difficult because you can't be awakened to the fact that those are just delusions and fantasies and dreams. You can't be awakened from death until God has freed you from that grinder of karmic consequence. And it could be very lonely there, because if you are living with fear of abandonment and loneliness, imagine feeling that on steroids when you're dead and there's no one you can cling to. Keep your secret a secret, 142, for your enemy is hiding in your shirt. Attar was not revealed this secret till he became his own enemy. Have you become your enemy? Your ego's enemy, at any rate. Because otherwise, you're not your friend. 145. Silence is to refuse to entertain that which is not the beloved. To fear is to imagine a shadow and then to wither in its shade. To imagine a shadow and be afraid of a shadow, and then to wither out of that fear and wither in its shade, which means you become the shadow. And that fear that the ego carries, which is your shadow, it becomes the identity that ordains the karma of your life. This is another octave. The breeze of dawn blows every particle of dust to ecstasy. Whoever received a robe of honor received it at this hour. Rise early and let your longing sigh, for nothing brings a human more joy or may elevate one as high. So he's saying, come to 4 a.m. meditation. That's the time, and it is the time. That's why in India it's called Brahma Muhurat or Amrit Vela, the time of the nectar, the time when Brahman comes and descends upon your consciousness and gives you ecstasy. But even those who come to meditation often fall asleep. They don't go into ecstasy because they don't recognize fully that it is the time to receive the robe of honor, the robe of glory, it's called in the Christian tradition. And you receive that robe by total surrender to God. 160. To have joy is to die to everything that will die tomorrow. Live only for the eternal, not for the temporal, because you'll be left empty-handed and in desolation when you lose it. Because it's destined all to be lost, everything that you hold on to in this plane. And most egos turn their strongest fragment into a scavenger to hold on to whatever they can get, to hoard it, to dominate, to manipulate, to become con artists, to try to control the situations of the phenomenal plane. not to surrender to the real. And so they create more karma and less joy. What is the sign of the path? That the farther you travel, the worse you become in your own eye. But, okay, let's take that as being a fact. If it is true, it is important that you recognize that you have indeed become worse in your own eye, but not the eye of the one who feels like a sinner, like a fool, like an idiot, like a failure, but in the eye of the superego that is judging you. And it's your clinging, it's the infantile fragment of the ego clinging to the parental superego that is causing it to experience that judgment. But only the death of the ego and the superego can release you. The only way you can get out of here without feeling you're a sinner and going through some judgment after death, if not in the throes of life itself, is to realize you do not exist. It's the only solution to the human condition in Kali Yuga. And that's why you're constantly getting this advice from Attar. It's 170. In both worlds, I am searching for the one who has freed himself from belonging to help me find an opening from this prison house I was born in. See, the ego wants somewhere to belong, and it either wants to belong to someone or to have someone belong to it, or both. But it is terrified of standing alone and not belonging anywhere in the world. But everyone who is honest with themselves realizes you're a misfit. You don't belong in this world. You are not of this world. But to face that fully means to go into vairagya and the elimination of your identification with the body vehicle that seems to be in this mirror of God's face. All right, let's see. One more. Page 341. Number 341. In the secret pages of the Alchemy of Union, I read that non-existence is the essence of true faith. If you don't want to remain locked out and perish in front of the gate to your true self, this you remember should you forget all else. So I think in this one he sums up all the other ones I just read. Non-existence is the essence of true faith, but one must be faithful to the one who does exist, to the real beloved, in order to hold on to non-existence, because otherwise you will not have the strength to let go of the illusion, because you'll want to hold on to something within the illusion and believe it's real. If you believe you are real in the phenomenal world as a bodily person, you cannot be faithful to the reality of God, because God is not real to the ego. And if you are real, if you are faithful to the real, to God, then you know you are unreal and non-existent as a character in the cosmic drama. That's the choice. That's the paradigm shift that has to be made if you are interested in salvation. I'll go back and read two more that I think sum it up very well. 151 on 33. if the whole world turns on you, do not turn back. Do not react. Swim in this ocean of phenomena, but don't get wet. You have to not care if the whole world turns on you. Look at the great saints and sages of all the religions. The best of them were burned at the stake. They were executed by the egoic lamas, popes, and mullahs, rabbis. They were excommunicated and they were rejected. But if you don't react, if you're not afraid, then you transcend. You must be fearless to get out of this eternally alive. So he continues on 152. The way out is to accept being naught, naught, nothingness, non-existent. And once so, to be pleased with that which is and that which is not. In other words, total acceptance of the hell realm of Kali Yuga, no importa. It's beautiful, it's perfect. Accept it as it is without resistance. There's beauty in it. It's a very surreal and dark beauty, but the human comedy is at its extreme point of farce at the end of Kali Yuga. And if you have a taste for farce, this is a very interesting time to think that you might actually be alive, even though you know you're not. And so to accept being nothing and not really here, but able to witness how the imagination of God is culminating this world in a totally surreal recognition of its own farcical nature and the madness of the mad dogs who are running the show, is proving that the higher plan and perfection of real intelligence is able to perceive and be unaffected by this and be able to use the information that is contained in the madness of the world's fall into its own inversion of its true nature, is giving us every piece of information we need to attain liberation here and now. So, we know what to do. They knew what to do back then, but today no one does it. You can read these poems, but do you follow the advice that you're given? Or do you just say, oh, that was wonderful, how beautiful. I want to read more of them. I love these trinkets. I'll keep it in my library. I'll treasure this book. It's not about that. Throw away the damn book, but become the meaning of the poems. It's the message that's important. Not the medium. And that brings us back to the lightning strike sutra. You remember, was it in chapter 6 where Subhuti asks the Buddha, but at the end of Kali Yuga, is there going to be anybody who gets it? Are they going to understand this teaching that you don't exist, sentient beings don't exist, even Buddhas don't exist, none of this is real? Is there anyone who's going to have the intelligence to be able to grasp this teaching? And the interesting answer Buddha gives, remember, is not only will they understand the teachings of this Buddha, but they will honor every Buddha, thousands of Buddhas, all the Buddhas. Now, what does that mean? A soul who has honored all the Buddhas must be a soul who has been here from the beginning, who knows the whole cycle of time. It's written in their soul. They've been there, done that. They have seen Buddhas come and go. They have seen and learned from every kind of master, sage, guru, messiah, any kind of wisdom that is available, they have taken in and repressed and forgotten. But it's there in the soul, you see. And at the end of time, the lightning strike comes that opens up that forgotten reservoir of knowledge that brings the oldest souls to the realization not only of the Buddha nature that they have learned from all the Buddhas, but from the fact that you yourself were one of those very Buddhas in a past life, and maybe in more than one. And then you fell and began to worship yourself in other lives and worship other versions of your Buddha nature. But it's yourself. Yourself that you've been following and seeking all along. No other. And so the mystery culminates in that, aha, of course, why didn't I get that before? Shivoham. It's that simple and that impossible for the ego because of all of the obstacles we have named, which requires the execution of the illusory ego self in order to know and to be who you really are. I think that's probably all I need to say or have to say. But I'll read one more poem to you. The one I'm going to read now is not by Attar, but by Rumi. And it's just the very opening poem of his magnum opus, in my opinion. Sometimes you'll see it called the Masnavi, other times the Matnawi. I think they have a Sephardic Ashkenazi split in Persian as well as in Hebrew, but you can pronounce it either way. But this is the book that he wrote toward the end of his life. Of course, he didn't write it. Rumi didn't write anything. He would just be twirling around the room in a love trance with the beloved, and one of his disciples would write down whatever comes out of his mouth, and he didn't even know what he said. But later, he'll check it and say, oh, okay, that makes sense. I might have said that, you know. So he just kept on ranting in his altered state, and his disciples kept writing. Well, it came out, they were six volumes, each at least as thick as this one, of teachings. And there would have been a seventh volume, but death cut him short in the middle of the sixth one. But in every volume, he gets more wild, more incredibly out there and into the level of the consequences of the recognition of one's non-existence. But in the first volume, he's talking more about the obstacles. And in the second volume, the courage to transcend. And then in the third volume, he gets into the soul level. And by the fourth volume, he's going beyond the soul into the heart of Allah and then beyond in the fifth. And the fifth is incredible. And I want to read from each of these to you at some point, and especially focus on the fifth and sixth, because they are extraordinary if you have reached a level of subtlety that you can really grok what he's getting at. But let me start with just the first one so you know, the starting point of the journey that he's taking us on, which is the same journey, but he's teaching us how to overcome the lack of courage on the part of that level of consciousness that connects the healthy part of the ego to the soul that could take the leap into the void, but doesn't. So this is called the Song of the Reed. Now listen to this reed flute's deep lament about the heartache being apart has meant. Since from the reed bed they uprooted me, my songs expressed each human's agony. A breast which separation split in two is what I seek to share this pain with you. Well, he wouldn't have any trouble finding split souls now, split minds. When kept from their true origin, all yearn for union on the day they can return. Amongst the crowd, alone I mourn my fate. With good and bad I've learned to integrate. That we were friends, each one was satisfied, but none sought out my secrets from inside. My deepest secrets in this song I wail, but eyes and ears can't penetrate the veil. Body and soul are joined to form one whole, but no one is allowed to see the soul. It's fire, not just hot air, the reed flutes cry. If you don't have this fire, then you should die. Meaning, go through ego death. Love's fire is what makes every reed flute pine. Love's fervor thus lends potency to wine. Of course, the reed flute is the poet, right? The poet cut off from the origin, from the depths of his being, and seeking that return through the lines of poetry that cry out to God and recreate a connection and lend the potency to wine, bring one into ecstasy that transcends anything that can be accomplished by plant medicine or any other assistance. It's the heart that creates the potency, the fervor of love for God, of the need for return to God. Okay, the reed consoles those forced to be apart. Its notes will lift the veil upon your heart. Where's antidote or poison like its song, or confidant, or one who's pined so long? This reed relates a tortuous path ahead, recalls the love with which Majnun's heart bled. The few who hear the truths the reed has sung have lost their wits so they can speak this tongue. The day is wasted if it's spent in grief, consumed by burning aches without relief. Good times have long passed, but we couldn't care. When you're with us, our friend beyond compare. While ordinary men on drops can thrive, a fish needs oceans daily to survive. The way the ripe must feel, the raw can't tell. My speech must be concise, and so farewell. So that's his opening. The human agony, the failure to transcend, but the pining, the yearning for that, for real love that cannot be found on the plane in which one projects the beloved onto another human being. So I'll read one more section of this opening song. Unchain yourself, my son. Escape its hold. How long will you remain a slave of gold? Of the capitalist system, of all the systems of the world. You've tried to fit inside a jug, the sea. It only has a day's capacity. A greedy eye is never satisfied. Shells only when content grow pearls inside. May not be true biologically, but true spiritually. while men whose clothes are ripped to shreds by love are cleansed of greed like this to rise above. Be joyful, love, our sweetest bliss is you, physician for all kinds of ailments too, the cure for our conceit and stubborn pride, like Plato here with Galen side by side. Plato, the metaphysician, Galen, the physician. He's on good terms with Greek philosophy, Rumi is. Through love, the earthly form soars heavenward. The mountain dances nimbly like a bird. Love made Mount Sinai drunken visibly, so Moses fell and swooned immediately. With my own confidant, if I'd been paired, just like the reed, such stories I'd have shared. Without a kindred spirit there to hear, the storyteller's voice must disappear. And if the rose should vanish from its sight, the nightingale will keep its beak shut tight. The loved ones all, the lovers just a screen, a dead thing, while the loved one lives unseen. When shunned by love, you're left with emptiness. A bird without its wings knows such distress. How can my mind stay calm this lonely night when I can't find here my beloved's light? Love wants its tail revealed to everyone, but your heart's mirror won't reflect this sun. Don't you know why we can't perceive it here? Your mirror's face is rusty. Scrape it clear! That's Rumi's teaching for the night. A very different approach to that of Attar, but with the same message. Floor is open, if anyone dares.
Thank you, Shinya. I love the sat sting. So in this case that you're talking about, when you were speaking initially about the weak and strong ego fragments, is there
like a single cause or a variety of them that would cause one to give ascendancy to the weak fragment?
Yes. The strong fragment is only relatively strong, but it believes the weakness of the weak fragment. And what it fears is that despite its intention to stay strong, it knows at some point the weak one will take over and it will fall into total anxiety and terror that it's made a terrible mistake by being too ambitious in going for it in life. And it will blame itself if something goes wrong. And it doesn't have sufficient faith that it can go through ego death and come out the other side and still remain conscious and fully alive and empowered to a degree that the ego can't even imagine. It cannot have faith or trust in that ultimate reality because it doesn't know it. And it only trusts what it knows from objective empirical evidence. And so to have faith in the unseen requires a level of trust in God that can only really be attained by the soul. So there has to be a shift that the strong part of the ego can make, not to total ego death, but to a therapeutic alliance with the soul, to use modern analytic terminology, an alliance in which the strong element of the ego can negate its own identity, both as strong and as weak, and recognize that its soul nature transcends both, and see both the strong and the weak as mental objects, but not identify with either. That's the only way out for the ego that's still split into these kinds of internal conflicts.
Okay. Thank you very much for the teaching. I could really resonate with the point when you mentioned that we're too engulfed in the ego to hear God's calls. And I was thinking about, okay, what are these calls? And kind of like everything here, the whole world, our whole being is a call from God, and everything around, the whole wisdoms, the sages, the poems, they're like pointers. Mm-hmm. And in one of the poems, it was mentioned that the human is a path which creates a connection between two worlds, and without mm-hmm. without the human, this connection doesn't exist. And the whole art is to see these pointers and also then follow the way. And we kind of like need so many pointers, like the whole world around us, until the ego is convinced. Mm-hmm. That was one thing. And the other thing that you mentioned, that the ego's main fear, it wants to feel safe, and it wants to be assured that there is security around it. And this made me realize that this beauty that the ego thinks, the security is beauty, it's not real beauty. The beauty or the real is that you must settle in the indetermining. And also what you mentioned with the secret of karma, that only suffering will make the ego humble and obedient to God. And this obedience to God is the real love. And then I kind of like, because the poems are so beautiful, I kind of like created a connection between love, beauty, and the unknown. And beauty, it's like, there is no love without beauty, and no beauty without love. And love has kind of like no ends. It's like a never-ending spring pool and has no boundaries. And then I also went further. What are these boundaries? It's like our own ideas, our own nostalgia. And finding beauty is like entering the unknown and to find different roads and the ability to wander. And I also then asked myself, is beauty mysteriously hidden behind the unknown? And then the answer in my mind was to find out and to uncover. It's kind of like the biggest freedom that one can have. And there is nothing which is more attractive than making the unknown and the impossible possible. And there was actually a connection between my Hatha yoga practice and today's teaching. I discovered Hatha yoga for me in a new way, because the way it is taught mostly is, I think, not really accessible to what really is Hatha yoga, because each asana is named after animals, plants, and it has a whole symbolism. And it really shows how the body and mind are connected. And today was the first time that I practiced, it's called Pincha Mayurasana. It's like a forearm stand, something athletic. But it's called peacock feather, and the peacock is a symbolism for beauty and also for vanity. And yeah, it's also portrayed in different cultures. Some cultures emphasize more the beauty, some others emphasize more the vanity, and then there is this question, do I see in the beauty the spiritual aspiration, or do I fall over into vanity? And the first time when I was practicing this asana without a wall, I felt the total insecurity. And on the other side, it was kind of like the most beautiful and conscious decision, because it was a symbolic way, in a physical way, but also in the mind, in the wisdom body, to be fearless and encounter yourself. And then I kind of like had this connection that beauty gives us the pleasure to uncover, and also the luxury to lose, and lose actually the fear to fall and embrace the insecurity.
Uh-huh. I would divide your discourse into two parts. What you said before you spoke of Hatha Yoga was the actual beauty of transcendence into the real, the supreme reality. And then when you went to Hatha Yoga, you shifted and you became enamored of the symbolic and of how the symbolic meaning of that supreme reality could be expressed in bodily postures, asanas, etc. But now you're only loving the reflection. You're not loving God's face, you see. And that reflection is a beautiful reflection, because it is a reflection of God. But it will keep you identified with the body and with the symbolic meaning of that higher truth, rather than to know that truth itself that's beyond words and beyond bodies. Because the real self that you are has no body. It cannot do asanas. It's not even in this plane. It's not here at all in space or time. And it's that self that you can know and realize while the body is alive, if you're willing to transcend even the most beautiful symbolic expression of that truth.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
And if you're only courageous and heroic in the symbolic level when you're doing asanas, that will be an excuse for living a life that is still based on the desire for security and safety. And then you will use that pocket of activity to justify yourself in remaining on the horizontal plane and not daring to complete the hero's journey, which means going beyond yoga into the absolute. And so that level of your being you should not deny, and you should recognize that it is important not to limit yourself to any mandala or any pattern of belief in any kind of activity that happens on this plane, because the self is completely inactive. It's not a doer. The self is the creative intelligence that underlies and saturates all of this, but has no identity on this plane.
Yeah, that's true. But is it the thing, because it is a pointer, you should not define yourself with an asana.
That's right.
And not defining yourself with the whole with this phenomenal plane, but seeing it as a pointer, and it's the art, because we are.
Yes, it is. It's one of many arts, but the question is, who is the artist?
Yeah.
It's realizing the artist, which is not the same as perfecting the art. It's a choice you will have to make. I'm simply saying it might be important for you to ponder that these are, in fact, two different approaches to life and will lead you to two different destinies. You choose which one you want.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much for reading this poetry. It was very inspiring, and I appreciated these points on the strong fragment of the ego and the weaker one, and then as well Rumi's poetry on courage and love and giving oneself fully to love. And I've been contemplating this and noticing how, I guess when meditation is approached just from the mental level, there can be a lot of anxiety and a lot of struggle going on inside. And the more love there is, the more it takes away that anxiety that's just very fearful and very draining in the end. I guess one difficulty, I guess the question might be is with that love, it comes to a point where almost there's a noticing of, wow, okay, I can let go and I can accept and I can just be at peace. And it seems like there at that last moment, there's this strong, very, very strong and very subtle resistance. Perhaps the strong fragment wants to let go. The weak fragment is saying no, perhaps because of that risk.
Yes. And then at the end, you let the strong one have a moment of peace, right? Which gives peace to the weak one too. But it's only a moment. And then the weak one will go into its suffering again and its complaints and all of that. Uh-huh. So that's the question. You can see both of these are mental objects. Neither of the two are you. All right? So it's the I, the belief that you are that one who has anxiety and who has moments of peace, but very few and far between, and mostly contraction and fear. And you have to recognize that's not your real self, and that it is time for that character to die, to be deleted without a trace, because it no longer serves who you really are. And you can't begin the hero's journey until the coward is removed. And that coward is not you. But that coward was installed in you when you were very young, probably by others who wanted to keep you under control and belonging to them and fearful of leaving them so they wouldn't have to deal with their abandonment issues. And so you remained captive to that family system and to that internalized self-image of weakness and fear, which you're still holding on to out of loyalty to those who in the past you loved and needed. And that neediness is causing the weak one to still feel as if that neediness is present here and now and isn't just a relic of the past. But it has no reality any longer. And you have already de facto transcended it, but you're still believing and having faith and loyalty to that self-image, which doesn't enable you to know the bliss of real samadhi, of real transcendence of the ego and union with God while alive. And you could have that at any moment at 4 a.m. in ecstasy if you would just give yourself permission to know who you really are.
And that permission, is that a letting go?
It has to be. You have to let go of who you think you are, but you know you're not really. You're pretending to believe that that's you, this weak character. That's not who you are. Why don't you drop that? That character is obsolete. It should have died long ago. That's what the rite of passage into adulthood is about. You kill off the weak infantile ego, and you attain the realization that you are the heroic manifestation of God. And you are, because of that, you are deathless, and so you live without fear. Without that, you can't attain your nobility of spirit, and you can't live in generosity and in the transmission of love and joy to others, because you don't have it to give. So how are you going to reach the bodhisattva level with that kind of a self-image? You're sabotaging your spiritual journey. There's no need to do that. It's all a fantasy, a delusion. And you know it's a delusion, but you're holding on to it tenaciously. Scrub clean the mirror, friend. See the sun shining in your heart, and then go to the sun. Not just look at the image, but realize yourself here and now. It's the only time you've got to do it.
Thank you.
Welcome. Sure, go ahead. All right. I like your courage.
Okay, I like your hat.
Since you made it, here's a plug for the Mad Hatter. She's on the prowl again and creating interesting Sufi masterpieces. May we be worthy of the cranial capping of that beauty by expressing beautiful thoughts that come out of our minds when we are attired with such royal forms. So thank you.
Haji.
What you got?
Well, I don't know.
Was it just for the plug of your hat? Is that it? A commercial announcement? All right.
Thank you for tonight. My question and where I'm going, well, one thing was there was, well, I don't know, is it okay to share a short one?
Sure,
that,
go ahead.
That I found impactful, and also because I have a question actually about your teaching from, was it Friday morning?
What's the question?
The question is about, well, this poem says, you know your beloved is satisfied with you when you're satisfied with yourself. And I found that very shocking because I feel like I rarely feel satisfied with myself, right? And I know there's the ego, superego, but also I think...
Yeah, but what's the first line of that poem?
You know your beloved is satisfied with you?
Yeah, do you know that your beloved is satisfied with you? You see, you're not connected enough with your beloved to receive the love that would give satisfaction. That's the problem. And that's because you have a preconception that you're not worthy of the beloved's love. And so, of course, he's not going to connect to you, and therefore you can't be satisfied. So you go on a self-improvement program to try to be worthy, and you make nice hats, and you do other things that are very virtuous and good, but you don't change the self-image, so you never reach that point where you feel like, I have the right to feel internal contentment and peace and go into blissful samadhi and live there. You see? Why don't you give yourself that gift? That's the hat you should wear. Okay, time is up for nearly all of us. May you give yourself, all of you, the gift of the liberation from the illusory identity and live in the true blissful nature of your infinite eternal being. Blessings to all. Namaste. Back to sting again.